Perhaps Mark, as has been suggested by some commentators, is aimed especially at the Roman mentality, as compared with the Greeks anyway, and you of course could compare them with the Hebrews and Assyrians and the Egyptians and things of that sort. The Romans tended to be practical, action-oriented, organized, etc. And of course Peter himself had such a practical temperament, so he probably fit well with the Romans in this. And that's when we read the little thing out of Clement of Alexandria about Mark. That's kind of the direction that goes, that the people in Rome were excited hearing what Peter had to say, and they wanted Mark to write it up. So that's perhaps what we've got here. Thus, there may have been a high demand for his material among the Romans, as our tradition from Clement says. Well, characteristics of Mark. We mentioned these briefly back earlier when we were discussing authorship and date. There's a vividness in Mark. Mark is full of graphic and picturesque details, which are not required for the action, but add some color and depth to the narrative. The 5,000 reclined on the green grass. Well, that wouldn't sound like anything in England or Eastern U.S. or something of that sort, but the grass is only green part of the year in that part of the world, so it is really kind of telling you something. Mark notes Jesus' emotion. He uses the historical present frequently to, we think, add life to the narrative. That's at least been a common suggestion on what the historical present does in the Greek. A lot of detail in Mark. Mark is shorter than Matthew or Luke or John, but he often reports incidents with more detail than do Matthew or Luke. Sometimes gives the names of the people involved, the time of day, the surrounding crowds mentioned, and these things are frequently not found in the other Gospels. Yet, as I said, Mark is the shortest Gospel. This shortness is obtained by omitting long discourses and reporting fewer events. Activity. Another feature of distinctive, if you like, of Mark is the activity in the Gospel. The action in Jesus' ministry is emphasized. This Greek word euthus immediately is often translated that way. It's used over 40 times and tends to give Mark's narrative sort of a rushed, breathless quality. Mark stresses Jesus' actions more than Jesus' words. Mark does not usually give long discourses of Jesus. As I've mentioned before, Mark 13, the Olivet Discourse, is much the longest speech in Mark. Mark is packed with miracles. 18 are recorded, though only 2 are unique to Mark. So that's characteristic then. So vividness, detail, activity. Aramaic. Many Aramaic words are recorded and usually translated into Greek. Some of these Aramaic words are unique to Mark. Boanerges, the epithet that Jesus gives to the two sons of Zebedee, meaning sons of thunder. Talita cum, Mark 5:41, the command to Jairus' daughter, little girl, arise. Ephatha, 7:34, the command to the deaf mute, be opened. Bartimaeus, name the blind man, just means sons of Timaeus. That Mark even translates the Aramaic name Bartimaeus suggests the audience had no feel for Aramaic whatsoever. There's Abba, 14:36, Jesus addressing God, meaning Father. That's used elsewhere and by Paul in Romans and Galatians, but not in the other Gospels. There are also some Aramaic words in Mark that are also found in the other Gospels. Korban, 7:11, gift to the temple, which is explained in Mark, but not translated in Matthew 27:6. A Golgotha, 15:22, place of a skull. Both Matthew and John use this, and all three translate it. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, 15:34, my God, my God. Matthew uses it and also translates it, as does Mark. Rabbi, Rabboni, used a number of times in Mark, 4 times, Matthew, 4 times, John, 9 times, but only translated once, and that by John. Mark probably used the Aramaic for vividness, but it may again be as the tradition suggests, Peter recalling the very words Jesus used or something of that sort. These quotations do not tell us that Jesus only spoke Aramaic. His conversations with a Syrophoenician woman and with Pilate imply that he had knowledge of Greek. Well, now I give a sketch outline of Mark, and let me walk you through that one again. We're looking at a considerably shorter gospel than Matthew by chapters. Matthew's got 28 chapters, Mark only 16. Preparation for the ministry in Mark only takes part of chapter 1. Then the Galilean ministry picks up in the middle of chapter 1 and runs to the end of chapter 9 and is not clearly divided up into public, limited, private, or something like that, just right there. Then you have the journey to Jerusalem takes up a chapter, chapter 10. The last week takes up 3 chapters and so about 10 verses, 11, 1 to 14, 10. Then you've got the betrayal, trial, and crucifixion takes up only 2 chapters, less than 2 chapters, and the resurrection, 1 chapter, and of course with the question of the last 12 verses of Mark, only 8 verses for the post-resurrection materials. So that's the Gospel of Mark. Move on to try to do the same thing now with Luke. Characteristics of Luke. Luke the physician. Luke is mentioned by name only 3 times in the New Testament. Colossians 4:14, Philemon 24, and 2 Timothy 4:11. So of the 3 people, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Luke is mentioned far fewer times by name. From these sparse references, however, we can infer that Luke was a physician and that he was loved by Paul, Colossians 4:14. That he was a faithful companion of Paul, even to the very end in Rome. 2 Timothy 4:11 runs up to the end in Rome. And he was apparently Gentile rather than Jewish. Have some zealous people say that all of the New Testament is composed by Jews, but the evidence is really quite strong that Luke is a Gentile. What's that evidence? Well, it's indirect, but Colossians 4:10 through 14 is a series of greetings that Paul is sending from his friends where he is to Colossae. And Paul breaks those into 2 groups. He says it in the middle of that. These are all of those from the circumcision that are with me. And then he goes on to the latter group. It's clear that the people ahead of that are Jewish, at least a couple of them it's clear from. And he says that for the whole group. And then Luke is in the latter group, is in the uncircumcised group, if you like. But in addition to these just 3 references to Luke by name, we have what we call the we passages in Acts. That is, places where the writer of Acts indicates that he is present with the others in the narration at that particular point. The author in these cases writes in the first person plural, including himself in the action. There are 3 textually certain occurrences of this. Acts 16:10 through 17, Paul's missionary journey. After Paul received the vision to go to Macedonia, we perceived, etc., us, etc., picks up there, and so on through that 8-verse passage. The group there consists then of Paul, Silas, Timothy, and the author. Use of we starts in verse 10, ends in verse 17, and that's geographically, they're doing some traveling then, it would imply that the author joined the group at Troas and left them at Philippi. Then in Acts 20, verse 5, we passages pick up again and they run on to 21:18, so over a chapter. This is on 3rd missionary journey. The usage is more spotty throughout this section, but note that the we begins in Philippi. So it ended a few years earlier in Philippi and now picks up in Philippi. Well, if you take kind of the simplest hypothesis, which is not always correct, the suggestion would be that Paul dropped Luke off to help with the new church in Philippi and that he was still there several years later when Paul comes back through Philippi. It goes on from Philippi and ends in Jerusalem. Perhaps the author is a delegate for the Philippian church in taking gift money to Jerusalem. He does not name himself, however, in the list of delegates unless he's not Luke. But it looks like Luke's practice is not to name himself in the book of Acts. Well, move on from there. The third wee passage is in Acts 27:1 through 28:16, the voyage to Rome. This is now two more years later. We picks up in Caesarea, where Paul has been in prison now for nearly 2 years, and ends in Rome. This suggests that perhaps Luke remained in Palestine with Paul to Jerusalem and then meets him 2 years later in Caesarea. For the 2 years between the third missionary journey and his fourth journey to Rome. And my suggestion is perhaps he used this time to research the gospel materials that he writes up. So when I was back there doing the dating of Luke, my suggestion was he researched the material for the gospel Luke, wrote it up, and had it ready before they left for Rome, that it begins to circulate in the East. He may have lost his copy in the shipwreck, we don't know that, so that might explain why the gospel circulates later in the West than it does in the East, but that's all guessing, huh? We also have one wee passage of uncertain text. That's in Acts 11:28, occurs in the what we call the Western text, and it's at Antioch before Paul's first missionary journey. The passage refers to Agabus, the prophet, in Antioch, and here the we may reflect just an early tradition that Paul was originally from Antioch, or, if right, as some have suggested, that Codex Beza and the Western family of manuscripts represents in Acts a slightly different edition of Acts. We don't know that. Then it may be even Luke's own remark that he was present at Antioch when Agabus showed up there. Mm. Liberals tend to discount the force of these wee passages by saying that the author of Acts, whom they think is not Luke, used a diary and extracted the wee passages as direct quotes. This is not the most natural interpretation of the phenomenon, but those things happen. Well, we move on, still talking about Luke the physician. Luke is a Greek physician. Given Luke's use of medical terminology, Luke was probably trained in the Greek medical tradition. We know something about it. The two most famous Greek physicians of antiquity belonged to the so-called Hippocratic school. Most of us perhaps have heard it one time or another, the Hippocratic Oath, the oath that physicians used to take. I'm not sure whether they still do or not, because one of them is to do no harm to the people while they're trying to heal them. The two most famous physicians of the Hippocratic school are Hippocrates himself, 4th century B.C., and Galen, 2nd century A.D., so after Luke's time. Some of the writings of the Hippocratic school are available today. We don't always know who wrote particular ones, and they give us their general procedures. These men and their associates were noted, that is distinct from many of the other methods of doing medicine in antiquity, were noted for diagnosis by observation and deduction. A rather important, what shall we say, medical movement in the Greco-Roman world was in the temples of the healing god Asclepius in the Greek and Asclepius in Latin, and their method of diagnosis was by divination. Okay, but the Greek Hippocratic school, diagnosis by observation and then making deductions from that by careful collection of case reports, so that a particular location or a particular doctor would have lots of case reports written up, which you could check against them and see, well, the symptoms look like this, what went on in that case and such. And as you get more and more of those, you begin to get some valuable information on how to treat various diseases. So case reports, lists of symptoms and treatments help to build experience or at least showed what not to do in various kind of cases. The Hippocratic school was also noted for simple treatments. They used some herbal drugs, they used diet, they used rest. They tended to stay away from exotic stuff like magic, putting dung on puncture wounds, or chicken teeth, or things of that sort. A nice discussion of these sort of things occurs in the book by S.I. Macmillan and his grandson, David Stern, I believe. None of these diseases. Good discussion of the Bible contrasted with some of your more exotic ancient medicine. The Hippocratic school is also noted for pretty high standards of hygiene. Well, it looks like Luke probably had this background. And it seems that in writing his gospel and Acts that he had interviewed people whom Jesus perhaps had healed and did it in kind of a perhaps a case report style. So occasionally get a number of medical terms that he gives in his healing miracles, if you like. Okay, some other suggestions about Luke. Luke's hometown. both Eusebius and Jerome from antiquity say that Luke was a native of Syrian Antioch. There were a lot of Antioch scattered through the world, but the famous one is the one there in Syria, which, as I say, fits that variant that shows up in the Western text of the New Testament. Well, Luke's use of the term Hellenists in Acts 11:20 apparently refers to pagans rather than Jews, and it may be that Luke means by Hellenist someone who was not Greek racially, but who adopted a Greek culture, and that would fit with lots of different towns, but would fit well with Antioch, where you had lots of Syrians who had adopted Greek culture, and so were Hellenists, but they weren't Hellenistic Jews, okay? So you've got this problem then of whether to translate Hellenists or Greeks in that particular passage in 11:20. And Hellenist is definitely the harder reading. William Ramsey, who has done a lot of work on Paul, thought that Luke was from Philippi, as this is where Luke is left and where he's later picked up. And of course, that's possible. But no particular reason for that. Luke would, Paul would obviously have used his associates to help in work with his early churches and such. Ramsey also goes on rather speculatively to claim that Luke was the cause of Paul's Macedonian vision. See a little bit of sort of a rationalistic approach here in Ramsey, that Paul had met Luke and so dreamed about him that night and went over to Macedonia with him, etc. I would say this idea seems rather unlikely, though Luke does appear suddenly in the narrative at Troas. If Luke is from Antioch, then apparently he either meets Paul accidentally in Troas, or perhaps had been sent out by the Antioch church to try and find Paul, and perhaps bring money or something of that sort to help with his missionary trip. Another suggestion about Luke is that Luke is the brother of Titus. Alexander Souter is the one who suggested this, and he bases it on 2 Corinthians 8:18, where the brother mentioned in that verse could be translated as his brother. Here's what the passage looks like in the NASU. Paul says, "We have sent along with him," and he's been referring to Titus just before, "we've sent along with him the brother whose name in the gospel has spread through all the churches." So Souter notes that Titus is a significant person in Paul's epistles, but strangely never mentioned in Acts. And he suggests that this is similar to the phenomena we see in the Gospel of John, where the author never mentions himself or his brother James. And so Souter then suggests that Luke minimizes all references to himself, and apparently felt that references to his brother would call attention to him as well, so it does not do that. Well, that's, again, pretty speculative, since Paul does refer to other people as brothers and frequently uses the term spiritually. Well, that brings us to the question of the aim and method of Luke. aim, we get an explicit statement in Luke. Huh? It's in the first four verses. And the aim of Luke is to allow Theophilus, the person to whom in the first case he's writing the Gospel of Luke, to know the certainty or reliability of the things he has been taught. So Theophilus apparently has been taught at least the basics of the Christian faith. Luke's aim, given in the prologue, Luke 1, 1-4, written in Greek, of an even more classicized, careful Hellenistic style than his usual writing. Prologue is compressed in comparison with that of other the prologues and other histories of the time, but then he's writing a one-volume history, and Josephus is writing a 7-volume or a 20-volume history or something of that sort. the prologue gives the same information in such prologues and serves as a dedication and explaining how and why the work was undertaken. Liberals are nervous about the term reliable, as it implies that someone tried to write as accurate a history of Jesus as was possible in about AD 60. If Luke succeeded, then liberal theology is down the drain. Huh? Most excellent, used as a title for Theophilus, is a title given to government officials. Such usage is seen in the Book of Acts, also seen in several other ancient Greek book dedications. For instance, writings of Galen and the early Christian epistle to Diognetus both have that kind of thing as well. Theophilus may or may not be a Christian. His name is what we call a theophoric or God-bearing name, Theophilus, a lover of God. And so some have said, well, it's just an allegorical name for sending this book out to all those people who love God. Possible. An allegory is certainly not unheard of in the Greco-Roman world. Yet God-bearing names like his were common in the Greek and Jewish cultures. So we can think of a huge number of theophoric names in the old Hebrew Old Testament and of Hebrew names of that sort in the New Testament as well. But we actually have a number of God-bearing names in the New Testament as well that are obviously real names. There are three of them in 1 John. See if I can remember them. Gaius, which apparently connects with Gaia, the Earth Mother, and Diotrephes, nourished by Zeus, Deus Trephes, okay? And what's the other one? Not coming up with it off the top of my head. That's why I've got notes here. I can't remember these things. So that's two of the three of them there. So we can't really very well argue that this person is imaginary merely on the basis of the etymology of his name. Presumably, in any case, Luke had a wider circulation in mind for this gospel. His intended wider audience is educated Gentiles. So he writes in a rather nice style and is writing in Greek, of course. Luke's prologue also tells us not only about his aim, but his method. We are told, first of all, that Luke was aware of the status of his subject at the time of writing. Many have undertaken to draw up an account. What's that about? As far as canonical Gospels are concerned, there couldn't have been more than two at this time written. John is certainly later, and Luke is writing a third one, if you like. So what does many mean? Probably is not referring to canonical Gospels at all, but referring to the fact that the apostles had been traveling around, first in Israel and then over the eastern part of the Roman Empire. And so people excited about what they were saying tried to write up what Peter or Paul or somebody was saying in a particular place, and hearing only a bunch of anecdotes, not able really to put together anything very satisfactory because they don't have enough information nor enough connections. And that's my suggestion of what's going on there. Luke says that he had studied all related materials carefully himself. He says he studied them from the beginning, probably a reference to the subject matter, rather than that Luke was with Jesus from the beginning. It's possible, but I think not likely. Luke does start with the earliest earthly events, huh? He goes back to Annunciation to Zechariah for the birth of John the Baptist, etc. He could alternatively mean the beginning place, Palestine. One can construct a history either by living through the events or by carefully studying the available data later. And a usual historical method turns out to be studying the available data later, just because not that many people are on the scene typically in a particular thing. So Luke is doing this, but Luke, we see, thirdly, used materials delivered by a group designated as eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. These people would obviously include the apostles and other full-time workers, such as perhaps the 70 or so, who were also eyewitnesses. A use of a single definite article for the two terms indicates the group is viewed as a unity, having both qualifications. We'll push that too hard, but he's seeing this as one group together. Luke probably interviewed many people who were healed or who were present at various of the occasions that he narrates. My suggestion is that Luke also may have interviewed Mary, since the Lucan birth material has Mary's perspective. It's possible that she's still alive in the 50s, being perhaps 70 or 80 years old by that particular point. Then Luke tells us that he wrote up an orderly, sequential, accurate account. and that should be encouragement to Christians. Obviously, all such claims as the above make liberals, again, rather nervous. This gospel, we're told, is written in Greek by a trained intellectual Gentile who had personally investigated the accounts of eyewitnesses. Rather striking. And so the general way to get away from that is to say, well, all writers throw stuff like this in the front of their material. But where Luke is testable, he has proved to be quite impressive. Some characteristics of Luke. Emphases of Luke's gospel. There are a number of features we can say that seem to be emphases of Luke's gospel. I'm going to mention here universalism, not in the sense of the Unitarian Universalist Church where everybody's going to be saved, but universalism, the gospel is for all kinds of people. It's not just for Jews. It's not just for middle class or wealthy people, etc. Luke has an unusual emphasis on both Jews and Gentiles, rich and poor, men and women, respectable people, and outcasts. In fact, with regard to the outcasts, Luke emphasizes Jesus' gracious attitude towards the outcasts of society, towards notorious sinners, lepers, Samaritans, harlots, tax collectors, and so forth. Luke also has a significant emphasis on prayer. More of Jesus' prayers and Jesus' parables on prayer are included in Luke than any of the other Gospels. Luke has considerable emphasis on social relationships, especially an interest in wealth and poverty. Why did Luke, what shall we say, stress these particular relationships? We don't know. We're not there. Perhaps because these would appeal to his audience. The Greek philosophers of the New Testament period, as opposed to the early Greek philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, etc., were very much concerned with ethics. Many cultured Greeks of the period were also interested in ethics and were unhappy with what they saw accurately, I think, as the debauchery of Rome and the high-handed running over of the poor people and such. So that may be what we see going on here. As we sketch some material unique to Matthew, so we sketch some material that's unique to Luke here. Luke, first of all, and somewhat surprisingly, has a much more Gentile gospel, if you like, than Matthew, preserves some Semitic praise psalms. these are, in fact, very Semitic, though otherwise the Gospel of Luke is the least Semitic of the four Gospels. The Latin names given for these particular praise psalms are taken from the first words of their texts and probably translated into Latin from Greek. and represents even a kind of a Hebraistic way of naming books and works and things of that sort. So there's the Magnificat in Luke 1, 46 through 55. Mary is concerned about how she'll be received at Elizabeth's house, and she's received very well because Elizabeth already knows about what has been revealed secretly to Mary, and John the Baptist jumps in her womb at the greeting of Mary. So Mary praises God, and Magnificat, the Latin for praise, okay, I praise. Then there's the Benedictus, Luke 1, 68-79, where Zechariah praises God after John's birth. And the Gloria of Luke 2, 14, the words of the angels at Jesus' birth, glory to God in the highest, etc. This is actually a little short to be technically a psalm, but would fit nicely with a refrain, kind of refrains that frequently occur in the psalms. And then there's fourthly the Nunc Dimittis, now let depart, in Luke 2, 29 through 32, Simeon's prayer upon seeing Jesus. He had been told that he would see the Messiah before his death, and now he has handled the baby Jesus and is ready to depart. Luke's gospel is not distinctive in having parables in it. All three of the synoptic gospels has parables, and the gospel of John has what are effectively the same thing, though he uses the word paroimia, where he refers to them. There are two general types of parables in the Gospels, what we might call story parables, which are quite adequately characterized by the phrase earthly stories with heavenly meaning, as a two-level, often even a secular story here, and then a spiritual significance that it has. And the wheat and the tares would be typical of such a thing. Earthly agricultural story of a enemy of a landowner trying to get back at him by messing up his crop, and yet it conveys information on the progress of the gospel. And then illustrative parables are also called example parables or paradigm parables. These are unique to Luke. There's one possible candidate in Matthew, Matthew 12, 43-45, and there's definitely an Old Testament parallel to it. But these do not transfer meaning from physical to spiritual or secular to religious or something. Instead, they picture a sample of the spiritual truth in operation, and we are to generalize the principle by hints in the context. Some examples of these paradigm or sample parables: the Good Samaritan. Augustine did try to make this into a story parable, with the man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho as Adam, man, etc., and falling among thieves. He's ambushed by Satan, and Jesus is the Good Samaritan, and the church is the inn, and he works out the some sacramental uses of the oil and such, the wine. But the context itself indicates, I think, that it's in fact a sample of what it means to be a neighbor, what it means to act as a neighbor towards someone, and the answer to the Pharisees' question, "Who is my neighbor?" The answer is anyone who is in need, and the principle is go do likewise, etc. So a nice example of a sample parable. I sample this particular disastrous incident of how to be a neighbor, if you like. Another example is the rich man and Lazarus, a sample of what happens after death. And a particular sample picks about as poor a man as you can imagine together with about as rich a man as you can imagine, and suggests that when they die, their statuses are reversed. That before, the rich man is inside his mansion feasting, and the poor Lazarus is outside with the dogs and the sores, etc. And then suddenly, with the death, Lazarus is feasting at Abraham's bosom, just like John at Jesus' bosom at the Lord's Supper. And the former rich man is outside begging, if you like. Well, there are people who want to make that into a story parable. Jehovah's Witnesses definitely do, so they can get rid of the idea of hell and conscious existence between death and the resurrection, etc. Pharisee and the publican is a sample of pride and humility. The rich fool, a sample of people who make no preparation for the next life. A little bit different, but I would put in the same category the parable of the banquet seats in Luke 14:7-11, a sample of the result of selfishness. A person selfishly tries to grab a great place at the banquet, but it turns out the host has invited somebody more important than he, and so he gets bumped out, and by the time that's all these other seats are taken, and he winds up getting down the bottom, if you like. The other one in the same context is the banquet host, Luke 14:16-24, a sample of hospitality. Who do you invite to your banquets? Not all the rich guys who will pay you back, not all your friends will pay you back, but the poor people who can't pay you back. And so what's going to happen then? Well, God will pay you back. It's a whole lot better, huh? Why is this type of parable unique to Luke? I don't know, okay? Liberals say various circles of tradition invented different types of parables, different types of materials. But this doesn't really solve the problem. There's no reason to believe that in such isolated groups in the early church. Perhaps a better model is that Jesus was inventive and used different types, different styles for various audiences. Luke apparently emphasized this material because he especially appreciated it. It's wealth and poverty and things of that sort show up pretty strongly there. There's some miracles that are unique to Luke. Those are miracles usually related to women. Jesus raises the son of the widow of Nain, heals the woman bowed down with infirmity, etc. And then one section that's rather unique, if you like, is the narrative of Perean ministry. Perea, a largely Jewish region east of the Jordan River, probably largely populated with Jews after the return from exile, even after the Maccabean period, probably. Well, we give a quick outline of Luke, and that will end our materials on the characteristics of the Synoptic Gospels. Luke has just a short four-verse preface, but none of the other Gospels have anything quite like that. Maybe the inscription on the front of Mark, the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus the Christ, the Son of God, if you like. Got birth and infancy, which parallel, at least in a structure and location, that in Matthew, but includes the infancy, birth and infancy of John as well. And then the preparation section has got the genealogy in it, whereas Matthew's got his genealogy up in the front. Then we have Galilean ministry, and that takes up middle of chapter 4 to about the end of chapter 9. And then has a big section, 10 chapters, of the journey to Jerusalem and the Perean ministry. The other ones all have about a chapter for the journey to Jerusalem and don't explicitly mention the Perean ministry. Luke's got about two chapters on the last week and two chapters on the betrayal, trial, and crucifixion, and one chapter on the resurrection. And in those areas, parallels the other synoptics very strongly. Well, that's our quick tour then of the characteristics of the Synoptic Gospels, and I think we'll stop there then. Thank you for your attention.